from the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean. Good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Christmas is now gone. New Year's Day, right around the corner. We'll have live programs for you on New Year's Eve and New Year's Night. By the way, thank you for the tons of Christmas cards I got when I came in. Wow. Appreciate it. Later tonight, riveting stories from David Sarita, so get ready for that later on. But here's what's happening. My, oh my, we have another plane missing, as you heard about it this weekend. The hunt for Air Asia flight QZ8501 has begun for a third day, with the search area now expanding far beyond the plane's original flight path. Now, what they have just spotted, smoke on a small island near Java. So they're going to check that out. Countries around the region, as well as the U.S., France, and Australia, are joining the search over the Java Sea. The Airbus carried 162 people. It disappeared on Sunday, shortly after leaving eastern Java on its way to Singapore. The pilot's last contact was a request to divert around bad weather, and then they just lost him on radar. This is the second plane to vanish. As you know, MH370 disappeared on March 8th with 239 people aboard. Now, Peter Davenport, of course, who heads up the National UFO Reporting Center, has also been raised around aviation. He's been a glider flight instructor for 10 years. He's been a commercial pilot, and I wanted to bring him in for his perspective on this. Peter, first of all, I have to ask you, when a plane simply disappears from radar, what does that mean?
Yeah. Isn't that interesting, George? And I'm sort of hampered because I think it was only yesterday that I first learned about this tragic incident, yet another tragic airplane accident.
Mm-hmm.
And my experience in aviation, which is relatively limited, but I've been around airplanes for the last 60 years of my life, I generally know which end of the airplane is supposed to point forward. And I'm hoping against all hope that this crash doesn't have anything to do with my field of expertise, namely flying saucers and UFOs. You just, in your prelude to this case, gave me about all the information I have on it. The presence of smoke on Java is an encouraging sign. I hope it's not another case where we lose an aircraft in deep water. Makes the recovery very much more difficult, obviously. But it takes me back to an incident that I alluded to very briefly a couple months ago, and that was the crash, tragic crash, with the loss of the crew member of that F-15 over Virginia.
Mm-hmm. I remember
and
that.
To the best of my knowledge, I have not pursued it aggressively, but to the best of my knowledge, the military has not announced a cause of that accident. And I'm hoping, George, that the leaders of this world, this planet, are not being somehow blackmailed by an alien presence. As you know, it is a given from my vantage point, based on the stream of information coming to me, that we are being visited routinely by UFOs. We don't know what they're up to, and I'm hoping that they don't have anything to do with any of these actions.
Well, as wild as those possibilities might be, Peter, and they are wild, you have to sit back and say, you got to add that into the possibilities.
Yes.
It's as strange as it is because, first of all, you know, I have flown, and I do fly about 45 flights a year.
Wow.
Speaking engagements, back and forth, you name it.
Yep.
And I've got to tell you, I've talked to some pilots. For a plane to just, you know, be 38,000 feet and then disappear off radar,
yep.
it either has blown up or it's been taken. But the fact that it just disappears off radar, to me, is very strange.
Yeah. The fragment should give a radar albedo, a radar reflection, and let it be said, I was just talking to an aviation specialist up in Fairbanks in preparation for this brief appearance, and he pointed out to me that that plane almost certainly had to have had an emergency locator transmitter on it, which can be activated by turbulence. What I don't understand is why There was no ELT signal that was picked up by satellite.
Well, just like the MH370, no ping. They can't hear anything.
These have me a bit worried, particularly the case over Virginia on the 27th of August, the loss of that F-15 with the pilot. That pilot was not only a seasoned combat pilot, but he was an instructor pilot in Massachusetts for the Massachusetts Air National Guard. And it does not make sense to me that a pilot with that kind of experience could have an emergency at between 30 and 40,000 feet above ground level and not be able to get out of his plane, not be able to transmit what his problem was. So I'm watching these things, but my experience tells me, George, that the best thing to do is sit back and wait for the NTSB or other investigators to start putting pieces together and see what they can come up with.
All right, Peter, thank you so much. I've been working with David Wayne, noted author and actor Richard Belzer, about the missing MH370 plane, and we've been kicking around various possibilities. And they're going to write a book, and I'm going to be part of it, that will come out probably in March about the MH370. The important thing about that is we have gone through a scenario of numerous possibilities, which you can also add into this missing plane, too. They're all very, very strange. Obviously, we'll keep watching this story as well. An estimated 7,000 properties around England and Wales will be sacrificed to rising seas over the next century. The coast of New England and Wales is being steadily eaten, they say, by waves, and climate change is projected to increase sea level and drive up the intensity of storms there. In Bingham County, Idaho, residents are reporting another mysterious explosion less than a week after the first blast triggered several 911 calls. Residents in a small town reported to the local media that they not only heard a loud explosion, but that the boom was powerful enough to shake their homes as well. Nobody knows what's going on there. Whooping cough may be evolving to outsmart the currently used vaccine, according to researchers. Analysis of strains from 2012 shows the parts of the pertussis bacteria that the vaccine primes the immune system to recognize are changing, and changing fast. Stores are packed with customers this time of year, but many who are there aren't shopping. They are returning holiday gifts, and its presence is a multi-million dollar problem for retailers. Let's check in with Mish Shedlock on this one. So they think they had a booming Christmas season, but now the refunds are coming.
Well, they did have a booming Christmas, at least I think. We won't see the final sales, George, here for a few more weeks yet. But we are seeing reports of lots of returns and lots of return fraud. This is about $3 or $4 billion, and return fraud is someone purchases a coat, say, for Christmas in October or November, wears it for a few months, they return it as new in December, you know, or you know, right after Christmas. So that's one of the things that's going on. But So with the sales, you know, we've got the fraud and we've got the returns. But, you know, I'm wondering if, George, if once again, people just plain out and out overspent. It's been 7 years. We had a recession in 2000. We had a recession in 2007, and no one sees one on the horizon, George, but we still have millions of people out of work that want to work, that want a job. The Fed is about ready to hike interest rates, and on average, we have a recession every 6 to 8 years. We're kind of overdue here for one, and no one saw it coming in 2000. Actually, very few of us saw it coming. I think you did. I think you saw it coming in 2007 as well. So let's just be careful here. But, you know, let's just step back a minute and say I wish everyone out there a Happy New Year. And there's millions of people out of work. And so that's my wish for 2015. That those out of work can find it, George.
Well, I hope so too, Mish. Thank you so much. The U.S. population has seen, get this now, at 320 million people so far. That's what they estimate, but they're pretty sure they're accurate. Up next, Sir Charles Schulz III joins me as we talk with him about advances in science for a couple hours. Next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our guest for the next couple hours, of course, the noted author of The Living Galaxy and A Fossil's Hunter's Guide to Mars, Sir Charles Schulz III. He worked at Martin Marietta Aerospace for a number of years on weapon systems and computer-based automated test equipment. Of course, he's been on our program many times talking about nuclear fusion. He's been knighted and received a long-term grant for his present research in robotics and AI, and here he is on Coast to Coast. Always a pleasure, my friend. You're getting ready for the new year?
Absolutely. I don't see how you could do otherwise. It's been an interesting year, and there's plenty to come in the coming year. I hope you've done the same.
Absolutely. So, Charles, I want to get your take on this missing plane, if you would. It's not specifically your expertise, but I find it strange that we have two jetliners that have disappeared within a year, lots of people on board, sad and tragic, but it's strange, isn't it?
Well, it's very strange. You know, we have really good technology for tracking things. We can see things from orbit moving on the ground. We can see radar signatures of just about anything in the sky or on the sea. It seems very strange indeed that an entire airliner would vanish not once but twice, and in the basic same area. There's something going on, definitely.
I think so. What's your gut tell you?
You know, I feel the only way that could happen is if somebody's intentionally turning the hardware off or looking the other way. And that might sound like a conspiracy theory, but the fact is we can see anything. So how can all these different countries with radar not see a plane at the same time?
Well, that's a good point. So what have you been working on lately?
Well, I've been working on a number of projects on the island of Montserrat down in the Caribbean, working to put a maker space in to help young people's education, to rebuild the economy after the volcano. The island's got a lot of development going on right now, so my wife and I have been down there for a number of months, setting up an institute to do some education, to help with the geothermal project, trying to create a green island nation, an example of the world where everything is sustainable and off the grid.
What do you see right now as some of the wonders of science, Sir Charles? I know you have your finger on just the pulse of all this.
Wow, we've had an excellent year for science and technical developments. We've had some amazing things happen. I think one of the first things that comes up is 3D printing. Just recently, they've effectively emailed a wrench to the space station. That's a pretty interesting thing. Well, you know, a lot of people have 3D printers right now, and they're available in a lot of places that you can go, like the maker spaces I was just mentioning. Hobbyists own them, and basically it's a method of taking a design in your computer and printing an actual working part instead of a document. So you end up with a machine that can print metal or ceramic dust or plastic and create a functional part for you. What's really going on now is that the printers are down around $1,000 or so, and there are some actual efforts to create some very tiny ones that actually could fit in the palm of your hand for just a couple of $100 or less. But I think what's really interesting is that we're capable of printing things that law enforcement, for instance, might not approve of, or the Food and Drug Administration
right.
might not approve of. And so it's caused an uproar. There is some move to legislate the types of files that you can get for the sorts of objects you can print on different printers. I don't know how successful that's going to be. I mean, how hard would it be to change a piece of, let's say, art software so you couldn't draw anything objectionable or pornographic? I don't know how you could do that. The same would apply to a 3D printer. But right now, we're seeing applications for 3D printing that could go so far as printing homes. That's been done. Engines and parts for spacecraft. And eventually, they want to put some larger 3D printers in space and print whole space stations or habitats. So we're seeing some real advances there.
That is amazing. They're also printing up noses and body parts. They're doing all these things now.
Well, absolutely. You may remember, I think it was in 2009, you and I did a show where we covered printing organs.
Yes.
And so there's a lot to be said about that. They were then printing windpipes, and now they're printing bladders. Just recently, they have actually printed an entire heart using, actually, it was a combination of techniques. They used a baboon's heart, if I'm not mistaken. They dissolved away all the tissue in it except for the scaffold, the structure itself. Now they take a biopsy of your tissue. They clone it. It's basically stem cells, and they inject the cells into the heart, and it grows an entire working heart for you. They've actually, in effect, brought a heart back from the dead. They've created an entire working heart that could be transplanted. But that's not all. Now, through the use of 3D printers and stem cell technology, they've created a working liver, an entire liver from scratch.
That's amazing.
Just think about where that carries us. There have been thousands of people on waiting lines for years.
That's right.
Waiting for organ transplants.
As resilient as the liver is, Sir Charles, if they could replace really damaged livers, livers with the cirrhosis and things like that, my God, they would save lives.
Well, they could, but let's go to the organ right next door to that, the pancreas. Look at how many people have problems with insulin, with diabetes.
Yes.
If you could print a pancreas, the Isles of Langerhans, the tiny nodules in it that produce the insulin and regulate it, that would be fantastic, and there has been some real progress made in that field as well. I would say over the next year to two, we're probably going to see the ability to get these organs on the shelf instantly so that you can have a transplant and not have to wait months or years or even die waiting for an organ that never arrives.
And these organs would be made from your own cell systems, right? Your own DNA?
Exactly. They have a method right now where you can go in for literally a liposuction where they remove some fat tissue. Those fat cells are treated with a chemical message that tells them to become stem cells.
Wow.
Because after all the cells have all the genetic codes built into them. So it simply changes the destiny of the cell to a stem cell. The stem cells are divided up into a number of different cultures, and some become muscle tissue, and some become cartilage, and some become all the different types of tissue you need, and they put them in cartridges. And these cartridges go in an inkjet printer, and the printer literally prints a layer at a time a new organ from scratch using your own tissue.
Is it going too fast?
I don't think so. I think that what's really happening is we're starting to catch up to where we should have been 20 or 30 years ago. A lot of regulation, a lot of, I don't know, turning your back on a good idea, a lot of that seems to have happened over the last few decades. Now we've reached a point where a lot of the naysayers have either retired or died off, and technology's going great guns. We're learning a lot of amazing things and making amazing advances. I think we're going to reach a point where we really don't have to worry about medical issues in just a few years.
Sir Charles, will it be a process, though, that the rich get the body parts and those people that don't have the money don't?
You know, that's often been theorized, and there have been good examples of that happening in many cases. I don't really have enough information, honestly, to say, but I think that this is going to be a very open process for a number of reasons. People have, overall, a somewhat better understanding of technology. They know if they can print one, we could print one. And it's been a slow process coming to the U.S. Many other countries that are thought of as having lesser technical bases have been doing this for years, a lot of them in South America, and the U.S. is just catching up. I really don't think that it's going to be as compartmentalized as just the rich getting it, because once this process is something that is well accepted, then insurance will probably begin covering it because it's cheaper than having to pay off on a death benefit than it is to keep a person alive, perhaps.
Well, that's a good point. It really
is. It may sound like a cynical way of looking at it, but I think a lot of it is determined by dollars and cents.
Of course, then you look at, you know, I just had a story. We've got over 320 million Americans now. People have argued how many more people can this planet sustain. What do you think? Do we have too many people?
Actually, no. And I'll tell you why. If you took every one of over 7 billion people on the earth and you put them in the state of Texas, each of them would have about 1,300 square feet, if I'm not mistaken. And that's just the state of Texas. Look how large the planet is. Now, that would be crowded, but it wouldn't be unduly so. We have the resources to produce enough power, clean water, and food and shelter for everyone on earth 10 times over. It isn't a matter of too many people. It's a matter of not managing our resources properly. On the other hand, I definitely think that we should have some pretty strict population controls because we're growing so quickly, we are wrecking our environment. We haven't yet put in place the proper methods of control to make sure that we don't destroy the world we live on. And it's happening slowly. But I'll tell you, I don't really feel, warm and fuzzy about the methods that governments are using, the decrees that they set up. And the reason is very simple. We've been told for years that global warming is going to destroy the world and it's such a big problem. And for years they've been playing this game with carbon credits, shuffling money and paperwork around.
Yeah, they sure have.
If they really were worried about the fate of the planet, they'd be planting something.
So, Charles, we're going to come back and go into space with you next. Okay, let's go out into space with Sir Charles Schulz III. You have loved space, Charles, for how many years? Since you were a kid.
I'd say all of them. All of them.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a fascinating subject. You think about the fact that the Earth, you have one world right here. You look straight up over your head, and there's an uncounted number of worlds and places to visit, exotic locations and opportunities. An amazing thought.
What's new in the world of space? What are some of the latest things out there?
Well, there's some fascinating things going on. I know that a lot of people heard in the news that the news from NASA was that they found methane and organic molecules on Mars. And they're not even certain where the methane is coming from. Some people feel that it's from geological processes, and others feel that it might be from microbes, because there are a lot of organisms that produce methane as they metabolize. So right now, the question is still open, but it's really interesting because the presence of organic molecules has been suspected all along. For the first time, it's been confirmed. And it's really simple compounds. But the fact that they've been detected indicates that there could also be other organic molecules present. These appear to be active organic molecules, something capable of doing something interesting, such as having a metabolism. There is no word yet on whether it's life, but they have found carbon-containing molecules. That's a really that's a big piece of news. Now, they haven't actually said that there are microbes, but there was, as you know, news about that back in the 70s during Viking. But what's more interesting is that the missions to look for life in other places are starting to grow. Congress just put $100 million forward for a mission to send a spacecraft to Europa, which is one of the moons of Jupiter. Now, some people know two of the larger moons of Jupiter, Europa and Ganymede, appear to have an icy shell and a liquid ocean inside. And another interesting fact about them is when their spectra, the color of the light coming from those two moons, was analyzed, they exactly matched the spectra given off by microbes that have been damaged by radiation. And some people feel that it's a good signature that there might be microbes living in the ice or in the water inside. So to answer the question, NASA is building a submarine which can actually be launched to Europa, can dig through the ice and encounter the water inside and look for signs of life. So that's going to be a submarine launched into space.
That's pretty dramatic.
Well, you know, to get exploration done, you sometimes have to do very unusual things. And when you think about it, this is probably the most amphibious vehicle ever made. It has to travel in space, on the ice, in a vacuum, and then in an ocean under the ice.
One of your works, of course, A Fossil Hunter's Guide to Mars. You're already convinced that we've had an abundance of life out there.
Well, absolutely. You know, if you look up in the skies, you see plenty of places where there are organic molecules in uncounted quantities. And we know that they're generated naturally just from the materials in space and simple forms of energy such as ultraviolet light, you know, the same thing that gives you sunburn from starlight or sunlight. And our sun is a star. And so in space, like around the orbit of Pluto and farther out, we've got a lot of icy, frozen worlds out there that are covered with a mysterious organic material called tholin. And it's this reddish-brown, tar-like substance. And it's being made in space by the ultraviolet light from those stars. It can be made by lightning discharges in an atmosphere or by volcanic heat.
No,
there's just an unlimited number of organic compounds in space and on other planets.
We've always thought that nothing could travel faster than the speed of light. That might be changing, right?
Yes, it might. You know, a couple of years ago, we had a case where they thought that they had measured neutrinos, subatomic particles that act just about like a ghost. They pass through nearly everything. And these particles appeared to be traveling faster than light. And later they retracted. They said, well, you know, it looks like the time of flight for those particles wasn't measured properly, that we had a problem in the time stamp on our equipment, the time it took the measurements and everything. And so they said, no, this isn't true. Recently, they've had some experiments that showed results that the neutrinos appear to show what's known as negative mass. Now, that's a real mystery. The only way anything could have negative mass is if it travels faster than light. So right now, The question has become more confused than ever. You'd think that more data would actually answer the question. At this point, nobody's really sure of anything. But the possibility that neutrinos might travel faster than light, at least part of the time, has been raised. So they're going to take some time, take some measurements, and do some more experiments and see what happens. But if it's true, then we could end up with a way of sending signals faster than light.
And if we do, will we be able to time travel?
Well, that's a much bigger step. I know that an unsatisfying case would be if you could travel very close to the speed of light, your time would slow down and you'd end up emerging some point in the future, and you can control that pretty accurately. As for going backwards in time, there does seem to be some evidence from mathematics that you could create what would be known as a wormhole bridge that reaches back in time. If you could make a wormhole at all, then yes, you could travel forward and backward in time. But there are probably some very strict rules about it, and so far we haven't seen any examples of it that we know. So that's still an open question, too. Personally, I think it could be done. I don't see anything that would prevent it. But it would probably be a really big engineering job to get it to happen.
Boy, if we can ever pull things up. What about teleportation, Charles?
Ah, now you're getting to some of the interesting stuff. You know, we've heard about teleporting a photon from one point to another, and right now they have the capability of sending a photon to a distant point without crossing the distance in between. They can actually teleport a photon using quantum teleportation. Now, that doesn't sound like a lot. It's just a particle of light. But you can write information on that photon and send that information to a distant point, and you can create a communication link that has no wiring or radio waves from one point to the other. And that is actually becoming a practical reality. But much more to the point, they've come up with something very, very interesting. If you create a pair of photons that are entangled or hooked together at the quantum level, they've discovered that they actually have the ability to reach out and destroy the distant photon up to 15 miles away as if by magic. Now, this is a really, really interesting thought. This is the part that really, really catches your imagination. If they can reach out to a photon that's nowhere near you and remove it, erase it, or destroy it, then all you have to do is create a stream of photons, send them to a distant point, and then at this point, where you're transmitting them from, destroy them selectively, and you end up sending a pattern of information. And that may move faster than light because of what's known as spooky action at a distance. That's a strange name for a quantum effect. Particles that are linked together and tangled to each other share a common destiny. And if you read the properties of one, you know the properties of the other. And that effect seems to move faster than light. So we've got another potential faster than light effect here. That could lead to being able to send and receive information instantly over great distances.
So maybe one day we might be able to teleport a rock, for example, or some inanimate object. But what about something alive?
Well, in theory, they would be one and the same. It wouldn't make any difference because the process of teleportation doesn't have any particular preference to something organic or inorganic. I think that if you were worried about the resolution of the thing you were sending and that somehow putting the particles together just the wrong way at a very, very tiny scale could kill something that was alive and not something that was not alive, there could be some concerns there. Sending a rock, you know, the rock doesn't really have any particular active components to it. And the crystal structure of a rock, you know, isn't something that's really, really difficult to replicate. When you're talking about organic molecules, they're very, very finicky in how they act, and they have to be very precisely assembled. So maybe there could be some issues with sending live things. But at this point, we don't even really have enough data to say for sure. We're only at the very beginning of the game, sending simple photons and writing information into single particles. It's probably going to be 3 to 5 years before we see an actual solid object teleported any distance at all.
What about 100 years from now? Then what kind of technology do you think we have?
Well, you know, that's a difficult question. I would say by then, if it's possible at all, we can certainly do it. And the reason I say that is because, as you know, the rate of progress is accelerating greatly. A lot of people refer to it as a singularity, the approaching time when information grows so rapidly and technology grows so rapidly that we can't even predict what's going to happen next. That's a fascinating thought, but it could also be a very dangerous thing. If the singularity occurs and in the next 5, 10, 20 years, then all bets are off and almost anything could happen. It would be pretty much a world of magic.
I think so, too. It truly is amazing, though. If mankind does, Sir Charles, survive 100 years, 500 years, at the rate our technology is increasing, we could be doing amazing things.
Well, we could. And, you know, when you stop and think about it, we're already doing amazing things.
Sure.
If you look back 1,000 years, they didn't have plate glass or, you know, complex alloys or any electrical power. And
nothing.
Yeah. It would be pretty, I think a lot of people would be hard-pressed to live 1,000 years ago after having lived in a time like today. But on the other hand, you know, we're resilient. Our job is pretty much to interpret the message of the universe and turn it into ways to survive better, to make life better for us.
Do you see shortly the time, let's say you make a phone call to somebody, and all of a sudden you get a little hologram of them on your desk talking to you. Is that possible?
Absolutely. There is a cell phone company that actually has come up with small hologram units that create a tiny image very close to the cell phone. And they're beginning to produce these soon, and you'll be able to actually project tiny holograms, just a couple of inches tall, and with actually very good resolution. This sort of technology is probably within the next year.
Of like a little person who's talking to you.
Well, exactly. I mean, we've all seen that episode of Star Wars where a little Vader statue, the little hologram, is standing there talking on the deck. And that's really, literally, probably within a year. That sort of stuff is already known.
That's exciting. It really is.
Indeed.
Back to Mars for a second, because you've shown us incredible pictures of incredible fossils that could depict life there, past life. Maybe there's current life, too. But when does NASA really begin to tell us, hey, look what we have?
You know, I'm not really certain. That's a very excellent question. They could have said that any time within probably the last 20 years. And, you know, you always expect an organization to be reluctant to step into the arena on something unless they're very, very sure about it. And at this point, there is such a preponderance of evidence that they could draw on. You would think that this would be something that would be all over the newspapers. I really would like to see them say tomorrow, hey, guess what? Look what we've got. I would be very, very gratified. As far as it goes, I think they're still at the point where they're doing a lot of analysis and gathering funding for the next mission, and nobody's decided to make a commitment at this point. But the fact is they could have done it at any time within the last few years.
What about other countries? Where do you see them, their activity in space exploration, including the European Space Agency, ESA?
You know, there seems to be kind of a loose agreement among a lot of the space agencies about a lot of things. There's a lot more technology being transferred and a lot of other information as well. I don't know if there isn't some sort of a gentleman's agreement between them to kind of filter things out. There have been a lot of people worried about the possibility of religious repercussions from people hearing about the existence of alien life. And I don't know if that's as large an issue as people say that it is. I mean, in a lot of places around the world, people accept the thought of alien life very readily. More or less, I think that it really comes down to the economics at this point and a decision that they're going to have to commit at some point. And I think some of them are very uncomfortable about information that they may have that they'll have to release at some point. And I'm not referring to anything like UFOs or any of that sort of information. But let's look at the fact that on the outside of the International Space Station, where the water vents from the wastewater system, there's material growing in a vacuum on the outside of the space station right there just because it has a wisp of moisture, just enough to keep it alive. The fact is, life is extremely resilient, and we'll probably find it everywhere in the universe.
I think so, too. In this primordial soup, as we've talked about, Sir Charles, it's the same all throughout the universe, isn't it?
Yes, it absolutely is, and it's present everywhere we've looked. In fact, right now, they're looking at like 7 or 8 different worlds in our solar system, moons and planets where life could exist. That's an amazing change when you think about it. Just a few years ago, a lot of people in the scientific community felt that the universe was pretty much sterile and dead. And here we're turning around and saying there could be 7 or 8 locations in our own solar system where we might find organisms. And not just in the ice. I mean, you know about the Dawn mission heading out to Ceres right now. They're going to be catching up with Ceres, which is a dwarf planet, the largest asteroid by some description, in the middle of our solar systems. Just to give the listeners a little bit of information, Ceres is a tiny world. It's less than 1,000 kilometers, about 600 miles across. It turns around once on its axis in 9.5 hours. That's its day. And it has a lot of ice in it. It seems to be about a quarter water ice. It seems to have as much water in it as the oceans do on our Earth. And they have a spacecraft headed towards Ceres as we speak. Right now, it is on the way to the rendezvous, and it should be there in probably about 3 months. By that time, we'll get some amazing pictures. They expect to see canyons and mountains and craters of ice and organic molecules all over the place. It's going to be a fascinating little microplanet to have a look at.
What has fascinated me, too, is when we send these probes out, and it takes 10, 15 years maybe to get to where they really are headed, technology has changed. Things have changed. It's amazing. When it gets there, it's there with old technology.
Well, you know, maybe that's a good thing. I mean, think about the fact that if you buy a new refrigerator, it lasts 3 years and burns up, but if you have one from 1970,
they're still gone. Yeah. Or those old Maytag washing machines, they still keep clicking along.
And you look at the Mars rovers. The Mars rovers are using DOS, you know.
Now, you have brought up an interesting question. Why is it that those old-time washing machines that ran, that had motors, and those old-time refrigerators that had motors lasted so long, and that the ones that we have now are almost expendable and breakable?
That, you know what? It's because of the way the systems are made. In the past, the old refrigerators, the old compressors in them were completely sealed systems. And the lubrication was basically the Freon itself. If you look at the back of a refrigerator from the old days, you have a little black rounded module in the back.
Yeah, like a little tank, right?
That's right. Well, the compressor motor, all the parts that move, everything active is completely sealed inside there, and never does any dust or outside material get in it. And so it's proof against its environment. Now, they started changing the way that they manufacture things. They changed the insulation on the windings. They changed the plastic laminations in the cores. They changed all the materials. They changed all the processes for making it. And each of those has a tiny but cumulative set of differences from the original old-style stuff. And they add up and interact in ways we can't predict. For instance, a certain piece of plastic might have a trace of solvent in it that reacts with a little piece of insulation on one of the wires somewhere, or a change in the type of solder that is used. All of these things add up to a recipe for failure. And in some cases, they're really not meant to last very long because they want you to buy another one.
Well, that's the big thing, too. I think they have made these units to break down. That's how you make your money.
Yeah, so it would seem. And the fact is, even recycled units don't end up being 100% recycled, so it's really a bad thing to do. It just makes the most sense to build the best appliance you can and charge top dollar for it because you get what you pay for.
You get what you pay for, but they don't do that. Is it also because a lot of these things now are made in China?
Well, now you've hit on another very, very important point. I think a lot of people are aware of the fact that a lot of the things that you get from China are really not very good.
No, they're not.
They sell very cheaply, and, you know, how are they going to make that that cheaply? They use really lousy materials. What's the last time you bought a device from China that had an extension cord that was only 1.5 feet long and stiff as a coat hanger?
And worked for a long time.
Yeah, you're wondering, how in the world would anybody make something like this? They've obviously not used appliances themselves, or they wouldn't burden somebody else with this.
Good point, Sir Charles. Website, of course, linked up at coasttocoastam.com, and he is an author as well, The Living Galaxy, A Fossil Hunter's Guide to Mars. We're going to come back with Sir Charles in a moment. An hour to go, science questions, your phone calls, if you want to talk with him about special 3D printing, how about producing organs for transplant, and also things going on in space. Get ready to make the call. I'm George Norrie. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. wherever you may be.